Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm Sarah Stevens and my guest tonight is Dr. Mary Getzey. A full professor at the Indiana University School of Music, Dr. Getzey chairs the Music and General Studies Department and conducts the International Vocal Ensemble, or IVE, which he founded in 1995 to provide music students with the opportunity to learn about cultures from around the globe by recreating their music. Her CD-ROM series, Global Voices, is a natural outgrowth of her work with IVE, and through this innovative use of technology, she now shares her exploration of the musics of other cultures with students and teachers all around the world. Mary's commitment to music education also led her to co-found the Mountain Lake Colloquium for Teachers of General Music Methods, which has become a central force in music teacher education. Furthermore, throughout her career, Mary has been recognized for bringing music to children through numerous published compositions and arrangements, and as an author of the series book published by Macmillan McGraw-Hill. Additionally, she is in high demand as a clinician in the U.S. and internationally, presenting regularly at national and international music education conferences. And, if that weren't enough, this year we mark the 25th anniversary of yet another organization founded by Mary, the Indiana University Children's Choir. Phew. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. Now, let's start out by asking you how your relationship with music began.
Wow. Well, I grew up in Missouri and on a farm. Not in a particularly musical family, but in a particularly musical culture. At a time when people sang, we sang at church, we sang at school, we sang at 4-H, we sang in the car. I even sang to the chickens, probably, because it was just a part of my life. And I attended a laboratory school on a college campus, which also was musically enriched because I was able to be in a band and an orchestra, the mixed choir, and the women's chorus, all within the school day. We didn't meet every day, of course, but I was able to participate in all kinds of musical ensembles, and I think that was an important part of what led me to go into music.
And so your community really supported bringing itself together through music.
At that time, yes, you even sang in the theaters. You know, the bouncing ball over the words was a part of the culture. So indeed, it was a musical time and a community.
So when did you begin to, this doesn't sound formal, when did you begin to formalize your interest in music?
Well, it sort of just happened by default. When you're that busy making music at school, you just sort of, I just sort of assumed, as did everyone else, that I would go into music. And I, in fact, majored in music education for a couple of years at a college in Kansas. But my piano teacher suggested that I really needed to get a better education. He recognized my talent and recommended that I transfer to Oberlin Conservatory of Music in Ohio. That I did, and I'm really grateful for the experiences I had there. Perhaps the most important ones came from working with Robert Fountain, who was both my voice teacher and my choral director. And that was the primary resource there for me personally in the, my musical development. But I also spent a year abroad studying at the Mozarteum as part of the Oberlin education. And that, of course, broadened my horizons a lot.
Well, that's interesting. When was that?
Well, actually, that was in 1963-64. And I was there when Kennedy was assassinated. And that was an interesting thing to be a part of. The other thing, which people are always amused by or interested in, is that I was there during the filming of The Sound of Music.
Wow. So were you in the movie?
I didn't actually participate in the movie itself. We were encouraged to do so because we spoke English, obviously. And but for me personally, it wasn't something I wanted to do. I had worked really hard to be a part of the community there and to think and behave like an Austrian. And into this beautiful town of Salzburg descended these mobs from Hollywood. And it was frankly kind of embarrassing because they were loud and rude and insensitive to the things we had worked hard to be sensitive to over the course of the year. So I wasn't inclined at that time to be in the movie and associate myself with them. It happened, though, that the dormitory where I was living was Schloss Frohnburg, and it was chosen to be, it serve as the Trapp family home in the movie. So I spent some evenings looking out my dormitory room watching the filming right below my nose. It was fun also because a lot of the students who were there did participate in the movie. So when I look at the movie, I see my friends, like all the nuns who are mouthing the words with the songs were in fact Oberlin students who were friends of mine.
That's funny. So you probably have interesting stories about those nuns.
Oh, well, I do. Well, they didn't behave like nuns in our work together, that's for sure. And one of them we knew was cavorting with the crew from Hollywood. And so it was a real shock when I watched the movie to see where that got her, which was a full screen shot of her walking down the aisle of the church.
And as a fan of The Sound of Music, I would love to watch it again now with that information in mind.
Yeah, you should watch it with me and I'll tell you, oh, there is this person and there's that.
I will ask you to do that. Let's take a little break and see what you've brought to play for us today.
I brought a piece by the Oberlin College Choir conducted by Robert Fountain. This particular one is Je ne le sais pas by Sertan. I think it exemplifies the wonderful a cappella tradition of which that choir was a part. Je ne vous dirai, et la, je ne vous dirai. Il n'est pas jaloux sans cause, mais il n'est pas bon du tout. Il a prêté ses lamelles au marché, s'en va à tout. Et la, je ne vous dirai, la, je ne vous dirai, et la, je ne vous dirai.
We have just heard Je ne le sais dire by Sertan, performed by the Oberlin College Choir. You're listening to Profiles. I'm Sarah Stevens, and our guest tonight is Dr. Mary Getzey. Now let's graduate from Oberlin, and could you tell us a little bit about where you went from there?
Well, I ended up in Indianapolis, actually, and while I was there, I looked for work, and there wasn't much for a person with a Bachelor of Music and Voice Performance to do, so I ended up teaching. It was a time in Indiana and across the country when there were really severe teacher shortages.
Now put a year on this for us, too.
This was 1965, and around 1966, and I answered the call when I read an ad in the paper for teachers, and they weren't even requiring that you be certified, and they were not requiring, actually, people to even have bachelor's degrees. So because I did have a bachelor's degree, I was able to take a job for a year. People who were without bachelor's degrees could only teach for 30 days, and they were called warm bodies. And so at that time, they were really grateful to have somebody with a bachelor's degree to keep the kids in line for a year.
And now, you hadn't student taught? You had
I had not done any preparation for that. And I walked in cold to a group of second graders. And it was actually, I often say, the happiest day of my life, or the first happiest day of my life at that point. I fell in love with teaching. I fell in love with the children. And I was stayed with elementary education for 3 years. And after that,
when you say you stayed with elementary education, you were a classroom teacher.
I was a classroom teacher.
Not a music teacher.
Not a music teacher.
And did you involve musical activities in your classroom?
Oh, we did indeed. I had a room and there was an old clunker of a piano in there. And so the children and I sang and I would improvise for them. And we just really had a good time and did little programs for the other classrooms. So, yes, it was the beginning without training of my musical teaching career.
That was what I was wondering. Yeah, indeed. I couldn't imagine that you weren't working that into it.
It's true.
Okay, now, what brought that phase of your career to an end? Why did you move on from there, and where did you go?
Well, I was going to formalize my education, get a master's degree, and become certified to teach, because I really knew I wanted to teach then. And the shortest route to certification was through music education, as opposed to elementary education, because I had accrued so many credits in music.
That makes sense.
So I came to the IU School of Music and began a master's program and got certified. It was at that time that I participated in a multiple arts program and actually had an internship teaching in the public schools, which then led to a full-time position in the local schools here in Bloomington.
Now, when you say an internship, what did that involve?
I was teaching music, art, and dance. We had specialists in music, art, and dance collaborating on a program called Multiple Arts. And so we integrated the experiences for the students.
That sounds interesting. And that has fed into everything you've done, in a way, since then.
Yes, I suppose it has in a lot of ways.
Because you integrate the arts now in everything you do, too.
That's true. I love to do movement with my choirs, and I'm interested always in the visual arts and crafts of the cultures that we're studying.
So it's interesting to go back and look at some of the things that shaped what you're doing now. So you're in Bloomington now, and you've gotten a job in the public schools.
Yes, that's about 1970.
Where did you teach?
I first taught at Arlington School, and then...
Which still exists.
Which still exists.
Yes.
And then I moved to both Brown and Elm Heights schools. And
which don't.
Exactly. Both of them were closed subsequently. The richest teaching experiences did take place at Elm Heights, actually. Those were the fondest memories I have of teaching were during those years from about 74 to 83. And I developed a program there that was strong and had, interestingly enough, a strong children's choir component. And so children's choirs began to be a focus. And so you can see, again, the bringing together of interests as I took my love of choral singing that had been there since my childhood into the classroom and brought it to a high level within the school.
Fabulous. So... When did you stop teaching in the public schools and move over to Indiana University, or was there a time period where you were doing both?
Yes, I actually did divide my time between part-time at Elm Heights and part-time at IU in the music education department.
And at that time, you started the IU Children's Choir?
Yes, around 1978, I would assume, was the time that the School of Music was performing a piece by Penderecki that called for a children's choir, and they imported one from Illinois, which may have been appropriate given the difficulty of that particular piece, but it seemed amazing to me that a community with as many musicians and music teachers and children as Bloomington, that they would have to bring children to Bloomington and to participate in an IU production. So the idea occurred to me that, why don't we have a children's choir? And I really didn't, at that time, there were not a lot of precedents for children's choirs as parts of universities. So in 1980, or 1979, actually, I proposed and was supported in the idea of founding the University Children's Choir.
Can you tell us some of the difficulties and challenges and excitement of bringing it together, of getting the organization going? I'm trying to think of founding an organization myself, and since I have founded no organizations, I'm curious to know how one goes about that.
Well, I don't think I did it in the way that might be most efficient, because I bore the entire weight of the organization on my shoulders. I measured all the kids for their outfits and heights and conducted three levels of the children's choirs, did all of the auditions, and wrote the newsletter. So I think in retrospect, I would hope that anybody...
You would delegate better, right?
Yes. But at that time, I didn't have a model, and I kept thinking of things that needed to be done, and so I just do them myself. And that extended also to writing music for the choir at the same time. So in some ways, it was a wonderful way to develop my own skills, but also a good way to burn out, which I did after 15 years.
I understand. But that organization is still a flourishing organization today.
Well, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience for me as well as for a lot of children. We traveled to Nashville in 1983 to do some sessions, and these were educational sessions because we emphasized the Kodai approach in teaching both in the rehearsals as well as in musicianship classes. So I took a group of children to the conference, and this actually marked the beginning of an important period in of the whole United States, because this was a national conference of the American Choral Directors Association, and Doreen Rao had brought many conductors together who were interested in children's choir at that conference. And Jean Ashworth Bartle from Toronto conducted the first national children's chorus. And it launched a movement that has gone far and wide across this country. I heard once stated, you can't swing a dead cat without bumping into a children's choir in this country. I don't go around swinging dead cats, but it's absolutely true that you'll find them in many communities throughout Indiana. And part of that goes to the work also of some of the people that I've influenced, like Henry Lack, who has a wonderful children's choir in Indianapolis and has supported a program that's called Circle the State with Song in Indiana.
Fabulous. Could you tell us a little bit more about... I mean, now it's such a massive organization, and it has lots of components, sub-choirs. Could you tell us how it grew?
Well, it started, as I said, with three levels of choirs. My philosophy was I would take every child. My job was to teach them. And if they couldn't sing when they came, we would teach them to sing. So we didn't eliminate anyone from the program who wanted to be a part of it. We just placed them according to their abilities. And then that evolved, so eventually I just took the higher-level choir, which we call the chamber choir. It's still called the chamber choir, actually. And the descant and treble choirs then were conducted by sometimes students who were studying with me at the School of Music, or occasionally interested spouses of students who moved through our community. Most of them were here for shorter times and were kind of training during that period. Now I think it's a little more stable in that we have more resident conductors in the children's choir as it has developed after I left. Then I went to Australia in 1991 and thought, gosh, you get little boys to sing when you have all boy choirs. I worked with so many boy choirs there. Then I thought maybe we should try having a male director and boy choirs to see if we could attract and retain more boys. Because almost every children's choir is 80% girls and 20% boys. That's a good ratio, actually. So I'm pleased that now there is a little boy choir still as part of the program, and that was one way that it developed. My approach was to start, based on the research I did for my own doctoral dissertation, to start children singing in groups after the age of 7 or 8. Now they have programs for the younger children, which is wonderful too. They have excellent preschool and early childhood experiences as part of the choral program.
Mm-hmm. It's called First Voices.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. At the higher level, we often had groups who said, I don't want to sing with those little kids anymore, but I still want to sing. And so we would form an alumni choir, SATB choir, for the high school students. And that came and went during my time with the choir. But now, again, that's another strong component of the choir that I'm pleased is going on. So this, it really goes from about 4 years old all the way through seniors in high school.
This leads me to two other questions that I'd like to ask. One is about your dissertation. Could you tell us a little bit more about your research?
Well, I actually did a lot of observations during the time I was teaching elementary school. And one of them was that I would have children, I would audition children in pairs, and one child would sing out of tune and one would sing in tune. And for some reason, I asked the in-tune singer to stop, and an interesting phenomenon happened. The out-of-tune singer moved to the pitch and continued in tune. And that just fascinated me. So I developed...
That is absolutely fascinating.
I developed a theory that the child who was singing out of tune when he was singing with someone else was actually listening to the other person and not to his own voice. And one of the important things that children needed to learn as they learned the skill of singing is to listen to and monitor their own pitch. So that led to basically a developmental sequence in which I taught people how to teach children to sing, and devices that help them monitor their own voice.
Fascinating and very helpful.
Thank you.
Now, the other question that I wanted to ask has to do with the alumni of the children's choir. Since this, you know, the choir has been in existence for 25 years, you have a huge body of alumni somewhere. Are you in contact with any of them?
Oh, I meet them, and obviously the Christmas season is a particularly rich time. I run into them at the YMCA or shopping because they come home to see their parents, and it's a wonderful chance to interact with them. And in fact, I was just speaking with one of them recently, and she said, I was telling her about the 25th anniversary, and she said, oh, I would come back for that. So I am going to make an effort to contact a lot of the students who have been in the choir with me in those first 15 years to see if they'd like to have a little reunion and make a little music together and perhaps even be a part of the celebration.
So any of you out there who are listening, please contact.
Please do, and I'll be on email watching for messages, and my email is goetze@indiana.edu, just my last name. So please come and join the fun.
Fantastic. That does sound like a lot of fun. I know a lot of the kids who have been in the choir, and so I know they'll be really excited to reconnect.
Well, it would be wonderful for me to reconnect with them, and always exciting for me to learn from their parents or from them directly that they've gone into music and that even some of them are choral conductors, and that's just is a
that's
great joy to me.
Really exciting, yes. Mm-hmm. What an impact.
Thank you.
I'm Sarah Stevens. You're listening to Profiles, and our guest tonight is Dr. Mary Getze. Now, I think it's time for us to take another break. Could you tell us what you've brought for your second piece of music?
Well, yes, this is well-timed because the second piece of music actually is a recording of some of the children from the children's choir singing some of my arrangements and compositions. The first one is called Infant Holy. It's a Polish carol that I arranged for the children's choir and which went on to be published. And another one was commissioned by the Indianapolis Children's Choir. It's called Fire.
Infant Holy, Infant Holy.
That was Infant Holy and Fire, performed by the Indiana University Children's Choir. The first piece was arranged by our guest today, Dr. Mary Getze, and the second piece was composed by our guest today, Dr. Mary Getze. Thank you so much. Now, could you tell us exactly what the Children's Choir is going to be doing to celebrate this quarter-century anniversary?
Well, they will be having a concert. In fact, they've commissioned me to write a piece for them, which I have. But I'm also thinking that we'll have a reunion, gathering together any of the alums of the Children's Choir to meet together, catch up with one another, and make a little music.
Fantastic. It would be wonderful to hear them perform on the concert, too. Is that a possibility?
I hope so.
Oh, that would be
great. If not at the concert, we'll do it at the reception following.
Sounds wonderful. Now, you're not still conducting the Children's Choir. You mentioned that earlier. You conducted it for how many years?
I was there for 15 years. I left the choir in 1995.
So 11 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. And I had an epiphany in the early 90s. And part of that began when I was writing a music text for the public schools. The editors said to us, this book will take the children of America into the 21st century. Wow, in 1991, that was kind of an awesome thought.
Now, give us a little more context on this. What book you were...
This was a series book published by McGraw-Hill called... The first one was called Share the Music.
How did you become involved with McGraw-Hill?
I was invited to become a part of the author team for that. And it was a really important part of my development. At that point, we began to look at series books. Frankly, I hadn't used them much because I kind of had my own method of teaching that had evolved when I was in the public school. So I was looking at them with new eyes as we studied the demographics that were projected for the children who would use this book. And when we looked at the percentage of African Americans, Asians, Hispanics, and Native Americans in the country, while the books were 90% European, the population was not. So we really tried to bring into the books music that represented all of the cultures that are present in the country. And that had a profound impact upon my own thinking about what kind of music really should be performed by children in our culture. Should it all be European? Should they all do music my way? And I began to question a lot of things about schools of music and what they teach and how they teach. In addition, I was traveling a lot. I mentioned going to Australia and several other countries to teach. And I kept running into the products of a colonization by European cultures. And I looked at some of the people, the minorities, and the people who had become treated like minorities, even though they might not have been.
Even in their own...
In their own country, their music was marginalized, and especially in university settings. Schools of music in Africa, Japan, Australia, everywhere have the same requirements that we have here in the IU School of Music, which is you're more than welcome to come, but you have to be able to make our music as well as we do. And I just really didn't want to be a part of that anymore and thought, what can I do? Add to the mix just listening to the nightly news, and I became really sensitive to the hatred and intolerance of religion and ethnicity and racism that abounds in the world today. And I turned a corner. I woke up in the middle of the night and said, I know what I'm going to do. And it was to form an ensemble in the School of Music that would actually honor these other musics and the way they're made. And fortunately, I was able to do that. And it began in the fall of 1995. And this is the International Vocal Ensemble. And it continues to today, and that has opened up a very new world to me.
This reminds me of what you said earlier about why you did not want to be in The Sound of Music. This is a thread running through your life, wanting to respect cultures as they are and not impose another culture on them.
I suppose that is true, and I hadn't thought of it. Thank you, Sarah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, could you tell us in a little more detail exactly how you teach the students the musics of the world in the International Vocal Ensemble?
Well, let me first just talk about how it's typically done and had been done before.
Yeah, that's a good
IBE,
idea.
And that is that typically when we would include in books, for instance, and in Share the Music, songs would be written down in notation. And it's amazing how much of the song gets sifted out. All you really retain are pitches and rhythms. How much can you learn of the music and the culture from looking at it on a piece of paper with a few photos around the edge and a few facts? And so I was determined to find a way that would honor the people who make the music, because I figured if we're really going to make a difference, if music could be a vehicle for building understanding, then we needed to see those people. We needed to know who it was who was making the music and why they made that music, and much more a deeper understanding than just singing the pitches and rhythms and hopefully an approximation of the language, or more often a translation of the language. So I decided that the best way was to bring natives of the culture to work with IVE, and I went about getting grants to bring people in to serve as what I called informants, and they would work directly with the students. Now, in most cases, I would travel, and the most important case, I traveled to the country and brought back video material of the music being made in context. And that in itself led to another way of bringing music to the students, which was through video recordings. And I would go and travel with my camera and interview people and talk to them about music. And over the course of that, I figured out what exactly we needed in order to be able to recreate the music, the pronunciation, the translation, having them slowly say the words for us, the parts, individual parts that they might be singing. And so a second way was to teach the choir through video modeling. That proved to be highly successful. The students learned a lot from the guests. And I might say also, when we used video, I often invited or would find someone from the culture to come and speak directly to the students, so that, again, it was humanized because they were in touch with someone from the culture. And I was learning along with the students. So even my role as teacher shifted dramatically. I was not the source of the songs in the way we are when we depend upon a score or when we teach by rote. These guests or the video became the model.
And again, this reminds me of something that you said earlier about how you were first introduced to music as a child, as part of a community, the context of a community. And so basically you have brought a number of different communities to the International Vocal Ensemble and allowed the students to become part of all of these different communities. What an incredible experience for them.
Well, it certainly has been for me. And one of the nicest forms of feedback came when they would graduate and say, "I want to do this song with my students. Can I use your tape?" Well, unfortunately, I hadn't gotten permission for transmitting it beyond my own ensemble. So that led to another piece of work that has now become central to my life. I went back and collected materials with permission from all around the globe, actually, to make models that can be used by people beyond IVE, so not only the students, but we formed a little company, and with a colleague, Jay Fern, we devised series of DVDs and CD-ROMs, which we started out calling Global Voices in Song and has evolved to just be Global Voices. And these are for the oral transmission of musics from around the globe, so that instead of looking at a book, when a classroom teacher wants to teach a song, they can watch a DVD and see the students in this culture, in context, singing the song. We've isolated all the pronunciation of the lines, the translation for them. And then we also have the movement. All of the ones have movement. Most cultures move. I always say, in this school of music, we wear black for all the performances and everybody holds still. But once I got outside the school of music, I realized how colorful performances are and how important movement is to the music making. So obviously we wanted to include that, and with instructions on how to teach these songs, or on how actually some of them I teach using this medium, the movement or the game or the dance. And then we have a large section of cultural information with interviews and seeing the children in, you know, various places. Sometimes they're in costumes for the performance, but we wanted the children to see how they dressed when they played on the playground. And so we just tried to give them a glimpse of the children who make that music so that it can actually build for understanding the parts that the ways in which the children are similar and the ways they're different.
So again, you're bringing communities together. It's not about music in isolation. It's about community building.
Yes, and it's true that I think music is perhaps the most powerful vehicle for learning and bringing communities together. Because when my students have reported back, I ran into this person from Ghana and I sang him the song, and he was so amazed. Mm-hmm. And I can remember many circumstances where when I've met someone, if I could break into a song of theirs, it just, you know, broke down any barriers.
I'm Sarah Stevens. You're listening to Profiles, and our guest tonight is Dr. Mary Getzey. Now, the International Vocal Ensemble, IVE, you just said that community building is one of your foci, that you feel that music is the best way to build community, perhaps of any. Could you tell us why?
Well, I have a lot of pet theories. So one of them is that the way we go about learning the music, most of this music is orally transmitted. That means we're not looking at a score. For music students, this is a real challenge because they've been reading music and everything is focused on the scores. And all of a sudden, you take that away and they have to rely on a very different means of learning the music. But when we take things in orally, we take them in holistically, and actually more connection is made in the right hemisphere of the brain. Tests have shown that when people read music, they use the left hemisphere of the brain, as we know for reading and speech and discrete detail. So it happens also that emotions are centered in the right hemisphere. And people have written for ages about how music is an expressive vehicle for emotions. So I kind of think there's a more direct connection with emotion through music that is learned orally, and that it's a really important part of the student's education, because they would come to me and they would say, this music feels so much more a part of me. This music is so emotional. And even the audience would sense that in the student's performance. And it's a very different experience to have people, we always sing from memory, looking at the audience, singing from memory, rather than standing there in black holding still and holding a score. So I really felt that the method by which the students are learning is connecting them with the emotions that are embodied in the musical expressions of these various cultures. And they begin to identify with and empathize with, especially when that's accompanied by the information about the culture and the context in which the music is made and the history. Certainly when we sing South African music, we are talking about apartheid and understanding what those people went through when this freedom song evolved. So I do believe that music has the potential to be a wonderful carrier of that kind of information, and that perhaps...
And almost a doorway into the culture.
That's it. And if we really want to build understanding between peoples of this world, which I certainly think no one argues with the need for that, then perhaps we as music educators can play an important role by learning music.
Now, could you tell us about some of your travels? I mean, you've created doorways for us into many different cultures. Could you tell us about some of the cultures with which you've become acquainted and you're helping to acquaint all the rest of us?
Well, I mentioned South Africa and certainly the southern African countries that were colonized by Europeans have wonderful music that has actually come out of their suffering. And so that's been important. I've been to South Africa twice and Zimbabwe as well. I've traveled a lot to Brazil, worked with an artist there by the name of Marluie Miranda and had her come to work with IVE. I've made a number of trips to Australia and New Zealand and have done a focus on the Maori culture. I haven't done one with Australians, Aboriginal cultures, for a variety of reasons. And more recently, my work has been supported by the Inter-Eurasian National Resource Center here at IU, and they have sponsored trips to Hungary and Azerbaijan. And in fact, just during the sabbatical leave of this year, I visited Kyrgyzstan and collected a lot of video material, which I'll be working on for a DVD about the music and culture of that country, as well as some children's games.
I understand that you're on sabbatical now, and you're going to be retiring soon. I can't even imagine you retiring. So you're not really going to retire. What are you going to do next?
Well, I'm sure you can guess that I hope to continue to travel and prepare multimedia materials for schools and for choirs and for people who are interested in learning from learning about other cultures. So I will continue doing what I'm doing aside from conducting the International Vocal Ensemble.
Fabulous. Well, I would like to go out on the last piece of music you've brought. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Actually, it's many pieces of music. What I did was prepare a medley of the International Vocal Ensemble singing songs from all over the globe. And one of the criteria for choosing these is to demonstrate that we do recreate the music, which means we try to sound the way they sound. And what people will hear in this is a variety of vocal qualities, because with each culture comes a different approach to singing. And this is quite innovative, I must say, and sort of risky to do in schools of music where bel canto-style singing has dominated for centuries. But we really enjoy the exploration, and I think that nobody dies from singing in a variety of vocal styles. It hasn't damaged any voices. We do take care of the voices, certainly. So this is a little trip around the world with the International Vocal Ensemble.
A fitting ending. Thank you so much. My guest on this edition of Profiles has been teacher, author, composer, and conductor, Dr. Mary Getzey. Mary, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
I'm Sarah Stevens, and thanks for joining us for this edition of Profiles.
Yeah. The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in January of 2006. Adam Schwartz, producer. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blackland McCord, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.